Welcome to Pardes Daily, where you get your daily dose of Torah with Pardes faculty. This month, Pardes is bringing Elul to you. Let's dive in.
Hi, this is Rachel Berkovitz coming to you from Jerusalem with Unit 4 of 20, where we're learning together the Mishnayot of Masechet Rosh Hashanah. Last time, we learned the Mishnayot that were structured in a particular way. They opened Mishnah 5, opened with a disagreement between the Tanakhama with the anonymous first statement and Rabbi Yossi regarding the capability of transgressing Shabbat on when that was a clear night. And then the Mishnah brought us a Ma'aseh on a slightly different topic, a story, an event that really happened, in which Rabbi Akiva's behavior was later reprimanded by Rabbi Gamliel and overridden. I tell you this structure to remind you because in Mishnah 7 that we're about to read today, we have a similar structure where there's going to be a dispute between the Tanakhama, the first anonymous voice of the Mishnah, and Rabbi Shimon, who says his opinion. And then we're going to have another Ma'aseh. And in this Ma'aseh, once again, we're going to have the behaviors of the original protagonist, and then their behavior is going to be overruled by the higher court. So we have a similar structure. Let's jump in. Mishnah Zion. Av uvano shiru et hachodesh yelichu. A father and son that saw the new moon, that saw the that crescent. And here in the Mishnah, this is really the first time that we actually have this phrase, saw the moon or saw the new moon. Up until now, in Mishnah, hey, we had whether it was seen or this way or that, but it didn't actually articulate for us what had been seen. So we finally have this phrase being used, and this phrase is going to be sort of at this end of this little couplet, it's going to be repeated and emphasized, right? And obviously there's a link between Chodesh being month and Chadash being new and the root. When a father and son together, they're out at night, they see the new crescent, they should go. Where should they go? They should go to Yerushalayim. They should go to the Sanhedrin. They should go to the court where they're going to testify that they've seen the new moon. However, the Mishnah continues, Lo shemitzarfim ze im ze, ela sheim yifsal achad mehem, yitzref hasheni im acher. The reason that they go together is not because they can join together one to the other, i.e., we learned in the Mishnah above that we need a zug, that we need a pair, we need two witnesses to testify to the new moon. So it's not that the father and the son are going to be that pair because they can't join together. Rather, that if one of them gets disqualified for some reason, their testimony isn't good, then the second one, right, if the father gets disqualified, the son can join with someone else. What if a single person, a singleton, saw the new moon and they came to the court to testify? Either the father or the son's testimony could join with them and the new moon will be able to be sanctified. Okay, this halakha that's being stated here, that a father and a son cannot join together to create the unit of two for testimony, is the basic law about all forms of testimony. We normally don't have relatives join together in being a pair. There seems to be an assumption where we want witnesses to tell the truth. We want to get to the truth of the matter. And that if you're related to the people involved, yeah, you could be unduly influenced, maybe accidentally, not realizing it, maybe on purpose. You might be a little biased in what you say. And so to sort of prevent these conflicts of interest, in halakha, in Jewish law, we don't normally accept pairs of witnesses that are related to each other. And in Mishnah Sanhedrin, they discuss the different types of what's considered related. Here, obviously, they're telling you the most related possible pair, a father and his child. Ksherim le'edut ha'chodesh. He says, a father and his son, and in fact, all the people that are karov, that are close, that are related to one to another, they are eligible le'edut ha'chodesh. And here we have that phrase again, the word chodesh with the word edut, to testify about the month. Finally, already in Dalet, we had talking about the witnesses, but we didn't have anything. They weren't even called witnesses there. We didn't even know what they were testifying about. We finally had the story sort of open up for us here. And it's in this phrase that they are eligible to testify about the new moon. So what does Rabbi Shimon say? He seems to be saying something like that this type of testimony, this type of edut, doesn't function the way other edut, right? It's not like I have a robbery case or a murder case and I need to get to the truth, right? This maybe isn't about the truth. Obviously, we want the witnesses to tell the truth. We want them to have really seen the moon. But that possibly that this is something more ceremonial, more national, more ritualistic. I don't know what word to use, but it's not the same thing. And therefore, I'm not concerned that there might be some undue closeness. I actually, Dafka would say the opposite. We've learned already in this chapter that there's something about the calendar that is about bringing people together, that is about uniting the nation, that even the people that are not Karov, that are very far away, right, that are not related, but are far away, that I have to send out the messengers, I want them to be exactly linked to me on this issue of calendar. And so possibly on that aspect, it's even more heightened. I don't have a problem if the minuscule microcosm of the family, the father and son, which maybe is a paradigm for all of Am Yisrael, see the same thing. We want them to see the same thing, right? And that's Rabbi Shimon's view. And now we have the case. The case is on a slightly, it's linked fathers and sons, but it has a slightly different emphasis. Maaseh Betuvia HaRofeh. There was once this story about Tuvia, a doctor. That seems to be who it was. Shara'at HaChodesh B'Yerushalayim Hu Ubano Vavdo Meshuchrar. He saw the new moon in Yerushalayim. He lived in Yerushalayim. He was near the court. And not only did he see it alone, his son saw it at the same time. And not only did his son see it at the same time, but his freed slave saw it. A freed slave, when the Mishnah refers to slaves, they're talking about Canaanite slaves, originally non-Jews, who for whatever reason are brought into the Jewish household as slaves. And when they are an Eved Kanani, then they have like a quasi-Jewish status, quasi-behavior of mitzvot. It's somewhat like a conversion process that they go through. And then they are capable of, their owner can free them. And when they are freed, they are free-functioning adult Jews. They are Jews to full extent, and they are free-functioning. People might know what their status is and their background because maybe they knew him in Tuvia the Rofe's office as originally as a slave, but now he's a free man. So all three of these people see the new moon, okay? And presumably they go to tell someone in the next line, V'kiblu ha-kohanim oto ve'et bano upuslu et avdo. The kohanim, and this is really interesting here, how are the priests involved in this story? Is it that this is when the Beit HaMikdash is standing and the court is in Yerushalayim in the Beit HaMikdash. And so when you first go to see the court, you maybe have like some guards at the door to check you out, to direct you in the right place, and they're Kohanim, or is this some type of court that's made up of Kohanim? Anyways, the court that's made up of Kohanim, or these bouncers that are made up of Kohanim, they accept him and his son. So they agree with the Tanna Kamma in our Mishnah that two people who are related can be Edim. And they nullify, they do not accept his freed slave. They say he is ineligible to give testimony. It seems to be ineligible inherently that freed slaves are not allowed to give testimony. And then it says, Ukeshabau lifnei Beit Din. But when they reach the Beit Din, right now they reach the actual place where they're going to look at the witnesses and decide if they're going to accept the testimony and sanctify the new moon. What happens? Kiblu oto ve'avdo upislu epano. Here, the opposite happens. All three of them continue on. They get to the court, and the court accepts him, Tuvia the Rofe, Tuvia the doctor, and his slave, or now freed slave. And they become the pair who are able to testify about the new moon, and they reject the son. He's ineligible, right? He's not inherently ineligible. If he had come with a slave or a freed slave or come with his neighbor, he would have been acceptable. But he's ineligible in a technicality with his dad, right? The Kohanim wanted to make the freed slave, it seems like, inherently ineligible, that he's not someone who can give testimony. Whereas the court accepted him. Okay, so this is really, really, really interesting to me. And it reminds me of Mishnah Bet, where we talked about the numerous, right? We talked about all the people of the world coming before the divine and the divine knowing their actions and that the divine creates everyone. And so it sounds like we've been having a conversation a little bit in this chapter about the nationalistic, particular Nisan, the Jewish people versus Tishrei, more universalist, all of the world. And now in our conversation about sanctifying the new moon, there's sort of a question, it seems to me, being discussed of, is there any inherent people that sort of have a blockage to being able to the ones to create this holiness of calendar time? And it sounds like the Kohanim, which I will point out, who are like genetically holy, father to son line going back, chosen by the divine as the bearers of the Avodah, the service in the temple, and have a certain kedushah to them, of holiness to them, right? So they're the ones that look at someone possibly who was, you know, originally not Jewish. I'm not saying you know anything bad. I'm talking from their own perspective, right? And if we use that example of the numerous, right, of the barbarians who like were outside the empire, right? If the empire is the Jewish people, the Eved Kenani was for sure originally outside it, then maybe became part of the empire when he was in his Eved state, and now he's perceived as a free citizen, but the Kohanim are saying, I don't know what rights that free citizen should have. I don't know if they could are capable to giving this type of testimony. And the high court is coming and saying, of course, this person is, right? And I think that Mishnah 2 maybe is an explanation for why that case is, because this person is also created in the image of the divine. This person was also created by the divine on the day in which the world was created, yachad, together with all the other human beings, Jews and non-Jews alike. And so possibly Mishnah Bet is a read to explain the Tanakhama's view in this Mishnah of someone who's joined the Jewish people. Once they join the Jewish people, they are connected to us in a way that it makes them capable of testifying about the calendar, the most unifying factor of nationhood that we have at this moment, and of going to be able to create the holiness in the calendar of the holiday cycle. And the Kohanim are overruled in this message. It's interesting if we compare this story to the story of Rabbi Akiva, right? First of all, we see that there are these smaller courts or lower groups of people that are looking to gain some type of authority. In both cases, there is there seems to be that the higher court wants to open up the game and expand the body of people who can come to testify, where the original smaller court or lower court wants to limit the people, right? With Rabbi Akiva, it was actually about numbers. Do I want less people to go or do I want more people to go, right? By saying I want more people to go, Rabbi Gamliel says, I want more people to be involved in this. I want more people to participate in this. I want more people to be active, right? And he particularly uses the word rabin, that I want more people to have this experience, right? And in this text, we're talking about a question of like, who can I include in participating in this experience? And once again, it's the Beit Din that wants to cast a wider net, where at least the Kohanim wanted to cast a more exclusive and limited net, which is interesting to see as we go along. In the next Mishnah, we are continuing to discuss who is eligible to give testimony. And the text says, Elu hen hapsulim. These are the ones who are ineligible, right? And the word pasul is an interesting word. It means like originally they were eligible and then something happens to make them ineligible in some way, possibly. Or maybe they were always ineligible. It says, hamesachek b'kubia, someone who plays with dice, a gambler. Milave beribit, and someone who lends with interest, a usurer, right, which is actually prohibited from the Torah. Umifrache yonim, and someone who flies pigeons, which people, the Tosefta seems to explain, like create sort of these pigeon fights, these bird fights. Possibly people are betting on those things as well. Vesochore shviit, and someone who sells produce during the sabbatical year. Remember the sabbatical year we had in the first Mishnah, right? The land's supposed to lie fallow. You're allowed to use the produce that grows naturally. You're allowed to eat it, but you're not allowed to sell it and use commerce with it. So these people are also breaking the law in some way or misusing their actions and their funds and their money. And then lastly on the list is the avadim, And right, we had the freed slave in the Mishnah before. Now we have the Eved Kanani, the non-Jewish slave who is obligated in some mitzvot and lives within the Jewish home. These people are ineligible. These people are ineligible. And the text doesn't tell us why they're ineligible. This list of the dice player and the usurer and the pigeon guy and the one who sells during the sabbatical, these four, they appear in a Mishnah in Sanhedrin, Sanhedrin Gimel Gimel 3:3. And they are excluded from testimony from all things, right? In monetary cases, capital cases. And so this list isn't unique. What's unique about this list is how it appears here. It has the addition of slaves, which didn't appear on the list in Sanhedrin, and it has the addition of the following challenging line. It says, Zeh haklal, this is the rule. Kol edut she'en ha'isha k'shera la, af hen einan k'sherim la. Any testimony in which a woman is not k'shera, is not eligible, is not kosher, so to these, the people that we just read on the list, it's not kosher for them. Now, this is a confusing statement because women weren't on the original list. I haven't been given a list of things of which women aren't eligible for. And so then how do I know that these people aren't eligible for it? It would have actually made more sense to say the opposite. This is the rule. Anything that these people aren't eligible for, oh, also women shouldn't be eligible for. Right? But to say the rule is anything that women aren't eligible for, but I haven't told you what that is, these guys aren't eligible for. And so this is a very challenging line in our Mishnah. If you're listening to me for the first time, there are many things I care passionately about, but the status of women within Judaism is one of them. And I have about 4 minutes to try to explain this Mishnah away to you. And I am not going to do it justice in any way, shape, or form in this short amount of time. We'd have to spend a lot of time comparing all the places where it talks about women and testimony and all sorts of things. But let's try to unpack it a little. Possibly the issue, why are these other people not eligible? Is it that they are not trustworthy? Is it that I think they're gamblers and they misuse money, so they're kind of like robbers and they're going to cheat me? And people who cheat in general, I don't think are trustworthy and aren't going to tell the truth. And then women aren't really on the list because maybe they're not cheaters, but maybe I'm worried that women also aren't trustworthy, possibly for other reasons, that they're under the domain of their fathers or their husbands. Maybe they can be more pressured into not telling the truth. That's one possibility, but of why maybe women's testimony isn't acceptable. I read a very interesting article by Professor Ari Malka to talk about these four categories of people and comparing it to Roman law, in which they have the exact same four categories of people excluded from giving testimony. It's even sort of more ceremonial things like you're not also allowed to take some magistrate positions. You're not allowed to vote. And the reasoning is that these people sort of lack moral judgment and they are overcome by they have a loss of control of their passions. They are greedy and want money and they can't control themselves. And in the Roman law, it was very interesting. The Roman philosophers identified these lack of control of passion specifically with femininity and with slaves, and that those are the paradigms of people who lack that, which is interesting that we see in other cultures these groupings of people together and similar attitudes about women. What is painful to me and challenging about putting women here is, on the one hand, the message that I see here in the Mishnah is quite a beautiful one, meaning what? That the capability of testifying about the sanctity of the new moon and therefore enabling the Jewish people to fix a calendar and create a holiday life cycle and be joined together all in one is something that is, in theory, open to everyone, right? It's open to all. It's not just something that the Kohanim do, and it's not just something that the rabbis do, or it's not just something that the high court does, right? It's something that all Am Yisrael participates in, and we want to encourage everyone to participate, and we're willing to, like, push the boundaries of who we include, right? And that is, like, a really beautiful message that I think is here, and therefore makes it a little bit all more gut-wrenching when I say that women aren't included in that everyone, in that all-inclusiveness, in that lack of hierarchy of wanting it to be something that the entire nation has a part in and it takes an active role in. And I want you to come and I want you to do it and I want you to be part of it, and that women are excluded from that. I think that I guess the only solace I can get from this that's so interesting about the other four people on the list is that it's all about actions, right? It's the actions that they do that disqualify them, right? And we had in Mishnah Bet this thing that God sees all our actions and that we're being judged about our actions, right? Which actually the Tosefta mentions that all of these four people, they can actually change their status and become eligible again to give testimony, right? If they change their actions, if they destroy their die, if the next sabbatical year comes and they don't sell the produce, right? If they get rid of their pigeons, if they tear up their promissory notes and their money, right? They can change the course of their actions and then change their status and then become eligible to be part of this everybody, right? And so even that's a beautiful idea. If part of the message here is about one's actions, that there's nothing inherently good or bad about people, but it's about the actions that they choose to do, right? I can be the numerous and align myself with the divine's army, or I can take actions that are going to be actively negative to my fellow man and going to make me ineligible for things. So those are all beautiful ideas. I guess my only solace is possibly to say maybe women's disqualification within this framework is something not about that is inherent to her, but about actions. I don't know if it's the actions of society in the way she's treated like the slave, and that society acts upon her in a way that she has a lack of control, but that there isn't a view here in this Mishnah that there's something inherent about these ineligibilities. And so I'd like to keep an open mind that possibly the pshat of this Mishnah does not inherently exclude women, but it is something about the way they function within society that at this moment they are excluded. But I honestly don't know if that's a great answer. And I'm going to leave it at that for today. And we will continue with the rest of the chapter tomorrow.
Thank you to our Pardes faculty. And thank you to you, our learners. Make sure to check back in at the beginning of each week to stay on track with your Elul learning, and visit www.pardes.org.il for more information about Pardes and our programs.